choupette refleurit tous mes rêves de bonheur. Je me souviens des soirs de danse, joue contre joue, des rendez-vous de nos vacances, quand nous faisions les fous. Souvenirs, souvenirs.
Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from ClassicRock.com, BGORecords.com, TimesOnline, NewsObserver.com, NewYorkTimes.com, The Financial Times, Wikipedia, and Entertainment Weekly. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This opening number is brought to us by the French Elvis, Johnny Halliday. Souvenirs, souvenirs.
Souvenirs, souvenirs.
We'll be hearing more from Johnny Halliday and about Johnny Halliday later on in today's program. But first, these trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us once again from ClassicRock.com, Classic Rock's Fascinating Facts. Question number one. Which singer was billed as the Rambling Yodeler in his early careers? Big hint here. Early 1950s sang Rock Around the Clock. Question number two is a true or false. Ray Charles was born blind. The answers to these two questions will be given at the end of today's program. The transition section of today's program is brought to us once again by BGORecords.com. Today in rock history. And today is January 30th and 31st. What were the number one hits this weekend? Well, back in 1961 on January 30th and 31st, it was the Shirelles' Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow? And back in 1964, it was the Searchers' Needles and Pins. Back in 1970, this weekend, it was Edison Lighthouse, Love Grows. Back in 1971, it was George Harrison with My Sweet Lord. Back in 1976, it was ABBA, Mamma Mia, on January 30 and 31, number one hit. And back in 1988, it was Tiffany, I Think We're Alone Now. 1999, it was Britney Spears, Baby One More Time, number one, back on January 30th and 31st. If you were born on January 30, you share a birthday with Joe Terranova, Danny and the Juniors, born in 1941 on January 30th, and Marty Balin of Jefferson Starship, born in 1942 on that date. And finally, Phil Collins was also born on January 30th, 1951, Genesis. If you were born on January 31, you share a B-Day with Terry Kath from Chicago, born in 1946 on January 31. Harry Wayne Casey, Casey and the Sunshine Band, he was born in 1951 on that date. John Lydon, Johnny Rotten, Sex Pistols, born in 1956 on January 31. And Justin Timberlake of NSYNC, born in 1981 on January 31. Rock miscellany this weekend. Well, back in 1956, it was Elvis Presley recording Blue Suede Shoes at RCA Studios in New York. Back in 1969, this weekend, it was the Beatles film and record Get Back on the roof of the Apple Building in Baker Street, London. Back in 1971, this weekend, it was Aretha Franklin singing memorial song at the funeral of Mahalia Jackson. 1972 this weekend, Joan Baez awarded gold record for a three-year-old LP, Any Day Now, an LP of Bob Dylan songs. 1973, Kiss make their live stage debut at Coventry Club, Queens, New York. Back in 1974, Greg Lake arrested for swimming nude in the Salt Lake City Hotel pool, clearly visible from the street. Back in 1976 this weekend, the 10cc's How Dare You hits the UK LP chart. Back in 1979, Clash began major American tour with Bo Diddley supporting. And finally, back in 1990, Bob Dylan is honored in France and becomes a commander in the Order of Arts and Letters. This final Transitions article is entitled Daughter of Johnny Halliday, who is today's featured artist, by the way. Her name is Laura Smet in Suicide Attempt. This is from timesonline.co.uk, published on the 5th of January, 2010, written by Adam Sage. Johnny Hallyday, the rocker nicknamed the French Elvis, whose narrow escape from death was a national drama last month, faced further trauma as his daughter reportedly tried to commit suicide yesterday. Laura Smet, 26, an actress, was taken to hospital after consuming medicines and alcohol and losing consciousness in a church in central Paris amid claims that she was torn between her father and her lover. Although her agent claimed she had suffered nothing more than a malaise, a medical source said she had tried to take her own life and had been admitted to Val-de-Grâce Hospital in the French capital in a serious condition. The incident comes a month after her father, whose real name is Jean-Philippe Smet, was placed in an artificial coma in Los Angeles with what he thought to have been an infection picked up during an operation for a slipped disc in Paris. His battle against a potentially fatal illness gripped his countrymen and dominated the news headlines for much of December. Although the 66-year-old Gaelic idol was released from the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles on Christmas Eve and appeared in public for the first time a week later, he looked frail and will have to rest for at least 3 months. The row over his treatment remains fierce, notably after the cancellation of what was billed as his farewell tour. Miss Smet is at the center of the controversy because Julien Delajoie, her partner, is the brother of the surgeon alleged to have bungled the slip disc operation. At the height of the storm, Dr. Stéphane Delajoie was beaten up by hooded men in Paris after Jean-Claude Camus, Halliday's producer, accused him of butchery. In a letter to a newspaper on Sunday, Miss Smet, whose mother, Nathalie Bay, is one of France's best-known actresses, denied that she was torn. "The only thing which is important to me is the health of my father," she wrote. "I am his daughter. I love him." Famous within months of her birth after Halliday dedicated a hit song to her entitled Laura, Miss Smet has earned prominent roles in successful films such as The Impatient Bodies. But she has suffered from depression and alcoholism in the past. "Success came too early, too fast, too hard," she once said. A police source said last night she had a history of suicide attempts. Her hospitalization comes a week after a French court ordered two eminent doctors to determine the reasons for Halliday's illness as insurance fought over the estimated Euros 30 million bill for the cancellation of his concert tour. If Dr. Delajoie is deemed to be at fault, his insurance firms could have to pay. If not, Mr. Camus's insurers will be asked to foot the bill. But if Halliday's alcohol consumption is judged to be the cause of his coma, he and his producer might have to pay the costs themselves. In classic rock news, with a local twist, we see this article written by David Menconi, written in newsobserver.com, published on November 5, 2009, entitled Spry Cohen Gives His All, Durham. As instruments of doom go, Leonard Cohen's voice is sort of like anesthesia. You'll be coasting along, basking in his mellow croon and letting it wash over you. Then a trance takes over about the time he drops one of his wicked kill shot lines on you. "You told me again you preferred handsome men, but for me you'd make an exception." Say, and the next thing you know, you're waking up wondering just what happened. And if you think that sounds at all unpleasant, then you weren't at Cohen's November 3rd show at Durham Performing Arts Center. Cohen's voice is an admittedly acquired taste, of course, and it's not one that has gotten much airplay in America over the years. And yet his songs have been in the air so much that you probably know more of them than you realize. Tuesday's show featured 27 songs, including most of Cohen canon, high points that the crowd had come to hear. The standing ovations began before he'd even sung a note. Then again, he rocks a dark suit and fedora so well he deserved the cheers just for walking on stage. Cohen is 75 years old, and he collapsed during a show in Spain back in September, but you'd never have known that from Tuesday's performance. He was spry from start to finish, sometimes singing from a knee for dramatic emphasis. By the end of the night, he was literally dancing his way off the stage. "I don't know when we'll pass this way again," he announced early on, "but it is our intent to give you everything we got." For this tour, Cohen has assembled a crack nine-piece band littered with virtuosos. They supplied sleek, exceedingly well-placed jazz-flavored rock that wouldn't have sounded out of place on a Steely Dan record. During each player's star turn, Cohen would stand off to the side, hat in hand, attentively watching and listening. Article skips down. But of course there was no upstaging the voice. When he reached down to the lower reaches of his range to intone the wisdom of old, during In My Secret Life, he sounded like a true force of nature, a foghorn warning the unwary away from the rocks of a romantic desolation. By now, Cohen is well established as poet laureate of doomed romantics everywhere. His typical song persona is a man singing from the depths of emotional wreckage, picking through the rubble and assigning blame where it belongs, as much to the singer as his subject. Just about every Cohen song has a cutting line that feels like an ice pick to his and to your heart. Tuesday's set list was pretty close to the track list on Cohen's current Live in London double album, starting with Dance Me to the End of Love, which set a tone of old-world classiness that he maintained throughout the evening. High points included the ultra-cold Chelsea Hotel No. 2, a steady rolling Suzanne, Hallelujah with lyrics tweaked for the occasion, I Told the Truth, I Did Not Come Here to Durham to Fool You, and Famous Blue Raincoat. He did two sets and multiple encores and seemingly could have played all night. "Good night, my darling," he sang on the show closing. "I tried to leave you. I hope you're satisfied." The crowd gave a massive whoop in response. This next article was published in the New York Times on January 12, 2010 by Ashley Vance, entitled Giving Electronic Commands with Body Language. Las Vegas. The technology industry is going retro, moving away from remote controls, mice, and joysticks to something that arrives without batteries, wires, or a user manual. It's called a hand. In the coming months, the likes of Microsoft, Hitachi, and major PC makers will begin selling devices that will allow people to flip channels on the TV or move documents on a computer monitor with simple hand gestures. The technology, one of the most significant changes to human device interfaces since the mouse appeared next to computers in the early 1980s, was being shown in private sessions during the immense Consumer Electronics Show here last week. Past attempts at similar technology have proved clunky and disappointing. In contrast, the latest crop of gesture-powered devices arrives with a refreshing surprise. They actually work. Everything is finally moving in the right direction, said Vincent John Vincent, the co-founder of Gesture Tech, a company that makes software for gesture devices. Manipulating the screen with a flick of the wrist will remind many people of the 2002 film Minority Report, in which Tom Cruise moves images and documents around on futuristic computer screens with a few sweeping gestures. The real-life technology will call for similar flair and some subtlety. Stand in front of a TV armed with a gesture technology camera, and you can turn on the set with a soft punch into the air. Flipping through channels requires a twist of the hand, and raising the volume occurs with an upward pat. If there is a photo on the screen, you can enlarge it by holding your hand in the air and spreading them apart, and shrink it by bringing your hands back together as you would do with your fingers on a cell phone touchscreen. The gesture revolution will go mainstream later this year when Microsoft releases a new video game system known at this time as Project Natal. The gaming system is Microsoft's attempt to one-up Nintendo's Wii. The article skips down. Just as Microsoft's gaming system hits the market, so should TVs from Hitachi in Japan that will let people turn on their screens, scan through channels, and change the volume on their sets with simple hand motions. Laptops and other computers should also arrive later this year with built-in cameras that can pick up similar gestures. Such technology could make today's touchscreen tools obsolete as people use gestures to control, for example, the playback or fast-forward of a DVD. This also, of course, would have implications for radio technology. To bring these gesture functions to life, device makers needed to conquer what amounts to one of computer science's grand challenges. Electronics had to see the world around them in fine detail through tiny digital cameras. Such a task meant giving a TV, for example, a way to identify people sitting on a couch and to recognize a certain hand wave as a command and not a scratching of the nose. Little things like the sun, room lights, and people's annoying habit of doing the unexpected stood as just some of the obstacles companies had to overcome. Jester Tech, with offices in Silicon Valley and Ottawa, has spent a quarter century trying to perfect its technology and has enjoyed some success. It helps TV weather people, museums, and hotels create huge interactive displays. This past work, however, has relied on limited standard cameras that perceive the world in two dimensions. The major breakthrough with the latest gesture technology comes through the use of cameras that see the world in three dimensions, adding that crucial layer of depth perception that helps a computer or TV recognize when someone tilts their hand forward or nods their head. Canasta, based in Sunnyvale, California, has spent 11 years developing chips to power these types of 3D cameras. In the early days, its products were much larger than an entire desktop computer. Today, the chip takes up less space than a fingernail. We always had this grand vision of being able to control electronics devices from a distance, said Cyrus Bamji, the chief technology officer at Canasta. Competition in the gesture field has turned fierce as a result of the sudden interest in the technology. In particular, Canasta and PrimeSense, a Tel Aviv startup, have fought to supply the 3D chips in Microsoft's Natal gaming system. At last week's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, executives and engineers from Canasta and Jester Tech were encamped in suites at the Hilton near the main conference show floor as they shuttled executives from Asian electronics makers in and out of their rooms for secretive meetings. Similarly, PrimeSense held invitation-only sessions at its tiny walled-off booth and forbade any photos or videos of its products. In one demonstration, a camera using the PrimeSense chip could distinguish among multiple people sitting on a couch and even tell the difference between a person's jacket, shirt, and undershirt. And with such technology, it's impossible, try as you might, to lose your remote control. This next article comes to us from NewsObserver.com, published on January the 12th, 2010, entitled James Taylor, Carole King Reunite for U.S. Tour. In the four decades since James Taylor and Carole King helped launch each other's storied careers, the notion of someday recapturing that magic never completely faded. Every time we would run into each other at a benefit or at an event, we'd say we'd have to get the band back together. Get that band back together and do some touring before the chance slips away, Taylor said in a recent interview. On Monday, Taylor and King announced dates for the U.S. leg of their much-anticipated Troubadour reunion tour. The tour, marking the 40th anniversary of the pair's breakthrough shows, will launch May the 7th in Portland, Oregon. King played on Taylor's 1970 Sweet Baby James album and Taylor on King's 1971 Tapestry album. We started performing. Originally, she was in my band, and then I increasingly encouraged her to sing her own songs, said Taylor. She was used to being a writer and to have other people do her tunes. Tapestry, released in 1971, sold more than 25 million copies worldwide and made King the first woman to win four Grammys in a single year. Taylor, 61, has won five Grammys during his career. Both Taylor and King, 67, are members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Songwriters Hall of Fame. The idea for a reunion tour had been brewing for years, Taylor said. Finally, 2 years ago, we played at a sort of anniversary celebration for the Troubadour with the original band, and that was so great we decided to take it on the road. Taylor said he and King will remain on the stage together throughout each show. I think we'll do two sets. Both of us will be on stage the whole time, either singing back up for each other or playing behind the other, he said. It's just going to be a blast. Despite his huge European popularity, the French Elvis Presley, our featured artist for today, Johnny Holiday, has so little publicity in the United States that we had to turn to Wikipedia.com to get the following information about him. His father, Leon Smet, was Belgian. His mother, Huguette Clerc, was French. The young Halliday took his stage name from his aunt's husband, American artist Lee Halliday, also a pseudonym. Halliday, whose music career has spanned a half a century, is one of France's biggest stars. He has completed 100 tours, had 18 platinum albums, and has sold more than 110 million records. Halliday announced his retirement from performing on 3 December 2007 at the age of 64 after a farewell tour. His career, influenced by Elvis Presley and the 1950s rock revolution, Halliday became famous in the 60s for singing rock and roll in French. His first album, Hello Johnny, was released in 1960. He appeared on the American Ed Sullivan Show with American singing star Connie Francis in a show that was taped at the Moulin Rouge nightclub in Paris. One of his concerts, 100% Johnny, live at La Tour Eiffel in 2000, attracted an audience of 500,000 and 9.5 million television viewers. The show was broadcast live on French TV. In December 2005, Halliday had his third number one single in France, dedicated to his adopted daughter Jade. Halliday remains largely unknown outside of France, thus earning the nickname "the biggest rock star you've never heard of" in English-speaking countries. He was made Chevalier Knight of the Legion d'Honor in 1997. Halliday hired Peter Frampton and the Small Faces to record on his 1969 album. Among their contributions are the songs Amen, Bang Bang, Reclamation, News Report, and What You Will, which are variations of Small Faces and Humble Pie tracks, and they can be heard playing on the album. For their first concert, the Jimi Hendrix Experience opened for Johnny Holiday in Evreux on October 13, 1966. Black and white footage, also from October 66, exists of Holiday partying with Hendrix and his manager, Chas Chandler, and others. In November 2005, Halliday started a procedure to obtain Belgian citizenship, but his request was turned down in 2006 because he failed to fulfill the residency requirements. In late 2006, Halliday announced that he would move his permanent residency to Switzerland to escape the high tax rate imposed by the French government. Swiss law allows wealthy individuals to claim residency if they live 6 months and 1 day in the country and then pay a fixed tax based on expenses, such as rent or assets in Switzerland, rather than a percentage of their income. Halliday has said that he would move his residency back to France if it changes its tax laws. Halliday keeps a second home in Los Angeles, where he has been spending increasing amounts of time in recent years, enjoying his relative anonymity in the U.S. One of his favorite leisure activities is riding his Harley Davidson on long trips through the California desert, staying in small hotels along the way. As you can tell from this biography, Johnny Halliday has done quite a few original pieces, but he also does covers. So we'll listen to some snippets from Johnny Halliday. We'll start out with Noir Cette Noir. You'll recognize that as one of the covers. And then we'll get into Les Penancières, another one that you'll recognize. And finally, a New Orleans. We'll end up today with the same issue that we started today's program with, Souvenirs, Souvenirs, which is probably the closest we have here mimicking Elvis Presley. But first, Noir Cette Noir. And now we'll hear a snippet from Les Penitentiaires.
Les portes du pénitencier bientôt vont se fermer. Et c'est là que je finirai ma vie comme d'autres gars l'ont fini.
House of the Rising Sun, and now finally, a New Orleans.
A New Orleans, hey, 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 hey. Au pays, yeah, au pays du Mississippi ou le Casnapi, on s'y les enchantés, tous serez éblouis, mes amis, éblouis par ces musiques folles qui claquent jour et nuit. Vous verrez sur bord des trottoirs des groupes d'enfants noirs, chanter des dixillions lorsque des grands le soir. New Orleans, hey, 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 hey.
And as I said before, we'll close out today's program with the same number we opened it with, Souvenirs, Souvenirs. But first, this review from Financial Times, published on March 7, 2009, entitled Tina Turner. The indefatigable Tina Turner broke pop's age barrier in 1984 when she became, at 44, the oldest woman to score a U.S. number one with What's Love Got to Do With It. Now, 9 years after retiring, the 69-year-old is back with a pyrotechnic, multi-costume, high-octane show, celebrating 50 years in showbiz. Fellow pensioner Mick Jagger, who Turner once accused of stealing her dance moves, will no doubt be taking notes. Turner claims she was pestered by the likes of Oprah Winfrey and Sophia Loren to come out of retirement. Such are the circles the Queen of Rock and Roll moves in. Was some shadow also lifted with the death of 2007 of her abusive ex-husband and original Svengali, Ike Turner? That we cannot know, as Tina does not talk about him now, but it was tempting to read a subliminal message in her choice of song after archive photos of the pair flashed up in a screen montage of her career. It was a cover of the Beatles' Help. The article skips down. There were no new songs, just hits spanning her rock and soul era, with Ike in the 1960s and early 1970s, and her renaissance in the 1980s when synths and power chords took over. A finale that found her swooping over the audience in another hydraulic contraption, belting out Nutbush City Limits, the hard-rocking ode to her childhood hometown, confirmed her as one of pop's great survivors. We looked up and marveled. This was given 4 out of 5 stars by the writer Ludovic Hunter Tilney. So how'd you do on the trivia questions? First one was, who was billed originally as the rambling yodeler? That was, of course, Bill Haley. Did Rock Around the Clock back in the early 50s. And true or false, was Ray Charles born blind? False. Ray Charles began to have vision problems at the age of 5, and his sight was gradually eroded by glaucoma until he lost it completely. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until...
Souvenir, souvenir.
Next time.
Nos beaux jours de l'été. Lorsque nous partions cueillir.